Well, we want to have Joe finish up the presentation, please. We'll reconvene the board. I think we have the audio and stuff fixed.
Can we make sure that Director Record and Steve O'Neill are on? Thank you.
Director Record, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. I have no idea where we're at on the agenda or presentation or anything. So if you could let me know, that'd be great.
No, we're on agenda item 4A, which is the action calendar. And I'll just restate it just to make sure that this is 4A is to approve and authorize an amendment with West Yost Associates for $66,900 for the potable water distribution system local reliability study and an additional appropriation of $76,900. And Joe Mawad is going to start off on the presentation.
And Joe, please
thank you.
State which
absolutely.
Slide you're on.
Absolutely. Thank you, President Sullivan. So over the years, the district has completed a number of water supply planning efforts. We completed our 2015 water master plan, and subsequent to that, we looked at water supply reliability and redundancy. And there were a set of common assumptions that we utilized among all those scenario planning efforts. And as shown here on slide number two, some of those common assumptions are that we will have additional water supply from an additional well in Moreno Valley, as well as an additional well in Paris Valley. We will be increasing our supply when the need arises from the Mills water filtration plant in Moreno Valley. And as the board is aware, we're currently under construction on the Paris to Desalter. That will be completed mid-next year, and that will produce an additional 8 CFS of supply. So within the scenario planning, all those were common. However, there were different alternatives that were looked at in terms of supply reliability, redundancy. We looked at the option to expand the Paris filtration plant up to 77 CFS, as well as the Hemet filtration plant up to 46 CFS. We also looked at expanding our water banking program in San Jacinto, which will potentially yield as much as 69 CFS. And then, of course, as you're aware, we have an ongoing effort, a planning effort. We're working with Metropolitan Water District to look at an additional supply of water from the Skinner filtration plant, including a transmission system that we would have to design and construct over the next decade. Since our master plan, as you're aware, we're also currently advancing our North Paris Basin groundwater program. Once completed, that program will yield an additional 5 CFS. So when we look at all these scenarios, what we recognized is that there are certain limitations if the Mills plant or the Skinner plant were out of service, and our ability to move water, be it to Moreno Valley to the north or to Temecula under each of those scenarios. So in our planning efforts, we did look at the reliability of our water distribution and water transmission system. And at one point, we looked at the concept of what would it take if we were to increase our transmission system across the entire district from north to south. And to increase that transmission system, there'll be a significant cost of $300 million. After looking at this scenario, we decided not to recommend that type of investment. However, we did move ahead with looking at the Moreno Valley area and Temecula area to see what can we do in terms of local projects to increase local water supply reliability in case of a major outage of imported water. And of course, we have to look at this in a phased fashion over the next 20 years. So I just completed slide three, and I'm on to slide four. So in working with our consultant, we identified an alternative that we would like to analyze, and that alternative is, could we feasibly and economically look at a filtration plant up in Moreno Valley that would produce approximately 40 CFS? How would that compare economically to some of the other options that were identified in the master plan long term? If that option is viable, then potentially we would not have to expand the Paris filtration plant to the same level as we had originally identified. So we would reduce that by 40 CFS. Another option, if the Moreno Valley filtration plant concept were to be determined to be viable and economical, the proposed additional supply from Skinner that we're working on currently, as you're aware, we're working closely with Metropolitan relative to potentially acquiring their easement, as well as the two existing barrels, San Diego Pipeline 1 and 2, that we can potentially repurpose. If we're able to reduce that supply from the Skinner plant by another 40 CFS down to 100 CFS, again, we're talking about long-term build-out conditions, then that opens up different options for us. In lieu of a new pipeline from Skinner, perhaps we can reline those existing barrels, and hydraulically we can get 100 CFS. We may not be able to do so to get 140. So there are some potential benefits and merits to looking at this concept of a new filtration plant up in Reno Valley. Of course, with a mills outage, as we experienced recently, that would be key to be able to meet all of our customers' demand under peak summer day conditions. So we believe this is a worthwhile effort to look at this additional scope of work with our consultant. So we negotiated a scope and fee with our consultant, as you'll see here on slide 5. With West Jost, the original contract was $285,000. This additional scenario analysis would require approximately $67,000. There's obviously additional labor by the district engineering staff that would have to be performed. So all in all, we would need approximately about $77,000 of appropriation, including an amendment to the West Jost contract. So with that, our recommendation is to approve and authorize the amendment with West Jost in the amount of $66,900 and the additional appropriation to complete the effort. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I'd move staff's recommendation.
I'll second it.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. We have a roll call, please.
Director Sullivan.
Aye.
Director Pauly.
Aye.
Director Corona.
Aye.
Director Slauson.
Aye.
Director Record.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, let's go to agenda item 5, which is the information items. First up will be the Southern Wine Country Infrastructure Phasing Plan.
Thank you, President Sullivan. Again, on behalf of Laura Barraza, I'd like to present this item. This is an informational item. We are not seeking any action at this time from the board. As you're aware, we advanced this study recently to have more clarity relative to the path forward with the concept of sewer system extension down in the Southern Wine Country area. So I want to cover briefly some background on the project. What were our objectives in advancing the recent study? The results and the findings, some of the cost estimates that were developed as part of the effort, and then some of the strategies in working with the other stakeholders, as well as potentially external funding support to advance a sewering solution down in the Southern Wine Country, and then a summary of the overall effort. So as the board is aware, with the Wine Country Community Plan, the Northern Wine Country area that we had worked with the county on and the vintners, and we obviously made significant investments in extending the sewer backbone, sewer infrastructure. We also established a special benefit area in Northern Wine Country. But beyond that, there is the Southern Wine Country area, which has a significant amount of equestrian land use, as well as there is proposed development in the Southern Wine Country, as well as there's residential areas in Southern Wine Country. So the Southern Wine Country area presents a different set of challenges, if you will, relative to sewering infrastructure. And again, this is the exhibit on slide 3. But I just wanted to recap on slide 4 what was advanced as part of the northern sewer infrastructure for the Northern Wine Country area. So as you recall, back in 2015, we completed phase 1 of the sewer system. That included approximately 30,000 lineal feet of gravity sewer. We had 2 lift stations that we constructed. In fact, the picture here on slide 4 shows the Armada lift station. We made sure that it blends well within the community down in Wine Country. With the lift stations, there's also force mains that were constructed. And in total, the phase 1 of the sewer infrastructure in the northern area of Wine Country, we can accommodate up to 4,383 equivalent dwelling units. The cost to date that we've invested is approximately $25 million. There is a phase 2. As connections occur over the next several years, there will be certain triggers that will require us to, one, potentially expand that sewer system all the way up to the proposed 12 Oaks development. There's also bottlenecks along Nicholas Road that we would have to relieve. So there are a series of improvements that would be needed as part of a phase two. Again, we're many years away from that because we still have ample capacity within the phase one system. So the phase two is estimated approximately $7.2 million. In total, it's about $32 million project for the Northern Wine Country. The county of Riverside has committed $5 million. To date, they've provided $2 million in funding, and we're working with them to budget the remaining $3 million. As you recall, we established a special benefit area to reimburse the district for its investments, and that annual assessment, or that assessment, has been annually adjusted every year based on inflation, and currently it's $9,972 per equivalent dwelling unit. So there have been connections that have taken place to our system since 2015. To date, 30 developments have either paid fees or entered into a participation agreement. The developments that have entered into an agreement with us total about 502 equivalent dwelling units. Again, recall that there's a capacity of 4,300 EDUs. We have received reimbursement from a development community of approximately $2.7 million. And currently, there's a little over 1,100 EDUs that are in various stages of entitlement or in planning to develop. So we are hopeful that we will continue to see additional connections realized within the Northern Wine Country sewer system. Shifting focus a bit to the Southern Wine Country, as the board may recall, back in 2015, we did complete a joint study with the Rancho California Water District that looked at the Southern Wine Country area and looked at the concept, and again, I'm on slide six at this time, that looked at the concept of extending the sewer infrastructure system to the Southern Wine Country area. And Rancho's interest, and back in 2015 and to this day, is protection of the groundwater basin. So by advancing the sewer system, by converting septic systems to sewer, there is a benefit in terms of groundwater quality. Thus, their participation in the 2015 study. At the time, there was a potential of up to 3,700 to 5,000 new EDUs that would potentially be connected to the system, and that was based on the land use plans for the area. So based on that information, the consultant at the time developed what would be the sewer system, be it lift stations. There were two lift stations identified, as well as sewer infrastructure. So it's quite an extensive system that was identified back in 2015. At a cost of approximately $24 million in 2014 value. And there was no time frame for implementation. Obviously, that this was a study to give us an idea of what would a sewering solution would look like, but we needed stakeholders and we needed funding partners to be able to advance a solution like this. More recently, we wanted to have more clarity, and also we wanted to look at the opportunity to phase in a solution rather than look at a comprehensive ultimate build-out conditions that I mentioned earlier. Is there an opportunity to leverage existing infrastructure, and is there a way to work with the development community, with the County of Riverside, and with the Rancho California Water District to incrementally advance a sewer system out in Southern Wine Country? So we looked at the remaining capacity within our existing sewer along Temecula Parkway, and there's approximately between 3,000 to 3,700 EDUs capacity remaining, depending upon which segment of the line you're looking at. So we wanted to leverage that remaining capacity or maximize it to be able then to look at extending the sewer further east to be able to accommodate growth and development in the area. So again, the study objective were to look at optimizing that system. We felt there's also an opportunity to consolidate the lift stations instead of having two. Perhaps there's an opportunity to have only one lift station. And what would be the site for such a lift station, and then look at an incremental phased approach to extending the sewer, and of course look at the cost associated with those options. And again, ultimately we wanted to generate what I would call a roadmap to help guide us in our discussions with the development community, with the county, with other stakeholders. So I'm gonna move in now with the next few slides to talk about the study and the information that was generated. I'm on slide nine. What I wanted to illustrate there is that there is remaining capacity within the Temecula Parkway sewer. And so when we look at the hydraulic conditions within that sewer, there's various segments, but essentially there's, as I mentioned earlier, there's somewhere between 3,000 to 3,700 EDUs. Now, mind you, an assessment district that was previously established several decades ago had paid for that sewer extension. So they have, if growth were to occur within that assessment district, they would be able to connect and utilize that capacity. And I believe the assessment district has been in place for more than a couple of decades. I'm sure, Dr. Corona, you're familiar with that as well.
Yeah, they had a assessment district 159, and then they had a supplemental.
Yeah.
So it's been around since about 89.
About 30 years. Thank you. So when we looked at the Southern Wine Country area formulating a backbone system similar to what we did with Northern Wine Country, we wanted to look at a phased incremental approach. And this exhibit on slide 10 shows the Temecula Parkway, and essentially the existing sewer terminates right before Area 1 that's shown there in the pinkish color. The sewer would have to be extended to serve Area 1 first. That is common to all the different scenarios that we looked at. But beyond there it would potentially extend up to Area 2. And then we looked at scenarios where Area 3, which you may be familiar with the Galloway Downs properties, that's where they're located, and then potentially Area 4. So we looked at various alternatives and various incremental extensions of the sewer to be able to serve all the highlighted areas shown here on exhibit number 10. The hatched color areas are actually RCWD properties, so they would not develop. And again, the potential, if I can go back, the potential development within the areas that are shown here on exhibit 10, based on land use, we estimated around 3,200 equivalent dwelling units. Again, within the remaining capacity, or approximately within the remaining capacity that we saw within the existing sewer along Temecula Parkway. So as I mentioned, we developed various options. The first option was to look at serving Area 1 and 2 only, essentially a backbone system there. The next option was to serve all the areas, 1, 2, 3, and 4. However, Area 3 would be responsible to design and construct a lift station that would primarily serve them and potentially Area 4, which is adjacent to them. So we felt, given that lift station would be triggered by potentially development community, that would be their responsibility. The third option was to look at what would it take in terms of a infrastructure as well as a cost to sewer all the areas, including the district being responsible for the lift station and Force Main to serve Area 3 and 4. So with option one, which is again a gravity-only option, we looked at the extension of the sewer from its current terminus, which is an existing 15-inch line, up through this Area 1, as shown here on exhibit number 12. And the and as well as then the extension in the blue of a 12-inch up through Area 2. That system would cost approximately $10 million, as shown here on the table. It would serve approximately 2,400 EDUs. And so if we were to break it down in terms of a potential SBA or CFD cost per EDU, it's around $400 to $300 per EDU. Again, this would be an entirely gravity system and establish essentially the backbone pipeline to serve the areas shaded in Area 1 and 2. Alternative 2 would be, again, to provide the oversizing to serve all the areas, including 3 and 4, whereby we would oversize the lines to accommodate the additional flow from Area 3 and 4. Having said that, what we don't show here is the lift station and the force main for Area 3, because, again, the assumption here is that lift station and force main would be advanced by development interest. So what we would advance under this concept is, again, the necessary sizing of the gravity line in Area 1 and 2 to accommodate all the flows generated, including that from Area 3 and 4. When we look at the total number of EDUs, we looked at all four areas, and that would be, as I mentioned earlier, around 3,200 EDUs, just shy of that. The cost of the project would be approximately $10 million. And again, because of the greater number of EDUs that this system would accommodate, then the assessment per EDU would be lower, around $3,260. The third option is the district, in collaboration with other stakeholders, would look at advancing a infrastructure system that would include not only what I just described on the previous slide, but as shown here on slide number 14, that would include the lift station that would serve Area 3 and 4, as well as the force main that would cross the creek, and then the oversizing needed to accommodate the entire 3,200 EDUs. So that entire system is estimated to cost approximately $18.8 million. And again, given the additional cost, same number of EDUs that we would serve, then the cost per EDU for an assessment would increase to around $5,900.
Joe?
Yes.
What about the area west of Area 4? That area already has approved track maps.
Right over here, sir.
Right. Yeah, right there. Pechanga Zone, about 60 acres of it. Where's that going to go? You're going to take that down to Margarita and then try to cross the river? Because that's where the second pump station was going to go.
Yeah. You know, I don't know, Corey, if you can help me respond to that.
Corey, could you come up to the, so Director Record can hear your response, please.
So the area west of Area 4, there is some current track maps and development happening there. That area is predominantly sewers west, and then up through the Red Hawk and 8159 okay. area. El Chimisal lift station is kind of that greater, pump station that gets out of that valley.
Okay.
Did that answer your question, Director Crona?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's that Morgan Valley area.
Yeah.
So instead of going north,
it's going to go
Hawk. West through the
Red Hawk.
Through the Red Hawk Golf Course area and stuff like that.
Okay. So slide 15 presents a comparison of the three alternatives that were examined as part of the study. The cost per EDU, the lowest cost per EDU in terms of a potential assessment would be option two, whereby the backbone infrastructure for area one and two would be constructed with oversizing to accommodate flows from area three and four. So we wanted to understand what the various solutions are. We wanted to develop a plan that would be adaptable, that we can utilize, again, in working with the development interest as well as the county and RCWD. And this is really just to inform our decision-making process going forward. At this time, we are not at a point where we are recommending establishment of a assessment district. We obviously need to work much closer with individual developers, individual property owners in the area to understand what their plans are for development and how we can work together to potentially implement what we see as the roadmap here for extension of sewer within the area. So in terms of funding strategies, we will work closely with the development community, and as shown here on slide 16, also we will be engaging, and we have been engaging, the County of Riverside. One funding option that we've discussed with the County of Riverside is the Enhanced Infrastructure Funding District. Again, this is the new version of the redevelopment agency, if you will, that the county is looking at. They have established, the County of Riverside has established a couple of these already, but it's not widely utilized. But we want to explore that option further with them. And, of course, the concept of a CFD. As I mentioned earlier in the past, RCWD has been very much interested in protecting the groundwater resources within the area. So we would like to engage them to see if they would be a potential partner with us on this effort. And then, of course, the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And also, we will be looking for potential grants and loan opportunities to help us advance this project, as we have in the past on other important projects. So in summary, this study provides us that guidance that we were seeking. We engage with the County of Riverside on a very regular basis. As development interests arise, be it in Northern Wine Country or Southern Wine Country, we are meeting with the county as they go through the entitlement process to understand how could we work with the county and our CWW, condition them accordingly. We obviously want to be able to accommodate development, and often if they are within proximity of a sewer system, say in Northern Wine Country, we'll work to extend that sewer. If they're not, then they may be phased in with the first phase on on-site septic. But we essentially are working closely with the county and RCWD to deal with those development or to help accommodate those development interests as they occur. But beyond that, we want to develop a framework to explore additional funding strategies and, again, have flexibility to adapt this plan as the need arises. And, again, we want to look at incremental solutions here for serving the Southern Wine Country. So as I mentioned, we will continue working with the stakeholders as identified here on slide 17, including the county, RCWD, the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and, of course, the development community is really key to this issue. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I just had a couple of questions. One, you know, this is kind of like a two-pronged thing. One, it's to a degree has been a request from the Regional Water Quality Control Board and Rancho California Water District, which I think they ought to be 50-50 partners if we do anything in this. Secondly, it's an economic development thing. You know, I think everybody here would like to get rid of septic systems if we can, just for the environmental part of everything that we do around here. But it's interesting to me that there's hardly any wells left up in the wine country, period. I mean, there used to be a lot of them, and now they're shut off. If I understand right, the wells there, I think there's maybe out of all of them that were done, there are three still operating. A bunch of wells are just there to monitor. But where does their true basin exist down there that they're all pumping from? I mean, at some point, if I remember right, because I was talking to Ben a long time ago, there's like 50-some-odd wells down through there that Rancho pumps from, mm-hmm. and they're rather deep.
Right.
And so, you know, how much of this actually pollutes that basin versus, you know, what we're going to spend for this. And then my other one was, at some point, not today, is that we're estimating to be about $4,000 a connection, which is really inexpensive. But how does that compare to the existing wine country, EDU? You know, I don't know what that is,
sure.
but you know, we're still kind of struggling with connections. And then, you know, there are some people down there that I honestly do believe want to put in hotels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know where that would be, like on a phased thing that they can be a participant. But those will be my questions when
sure.
we come back. And Steve knows more about, you know, how many wells are down there that Rancho pumps from and,
yeah.
you know, what the water quality is and is it really being degraded by the existing septic systems up there?
So my understanding, President Sullivan, is that within the Southern Wine Country area, in fact, RCW has a number of wells. That's where they have some of their recharge facilities down in that area, and they have a number of their wells. So it is a key component of their local groundwater resources. They have, as I mentioned, an interest in protecting the groundwater quality. That's why they participated in us with us back in 2015 for the study. So we will be reaching out to them. We will be sharing with them this information and gauge their interest to work with us to advance a solution out there. Relative to the assessment, you're absolutely right. One of the options looked at approximately $4,000 per EDU. That compared to the current assessment up north, as I mentioned earlier, the current assessment is about $9,900. So it's obviously less than half. At least that's what we're estimating. But we'd have to work through the details, through the phasing, through the actual design and construction a little further to be able to fine tune and refine that. But the initial thought is that one of the options we could advance a solution for about $4,000 assessment per EDU that would develop and connect there. I don't know
that does. Yeah, I'm sure at some point we'd want to understand how, you know, what percent does this benefit Rancho California Water District's ground basin down there? Because
mm-hmm.
I would think that they would want to make a financial mm-hmm. investment in this, not just in the study, but in the construction of the sewer.
Right.
hopefully.
That's all I had.
I had a question back on the oversizing on the Di Portola. Mm-hmm. So you're gonna, if you put in a pump station on for Area 3, mm-hmm. then you're gonna oversize Di Portola.
Yes.
Who's paying for that? Area 3? Because clearly, if it's a gravity-only system, Area 1 and 2 don't need it.
Yeah, so, and I don't know if we have the ability to go back to that slide. That's a good question, Darshan
Karan. And then I have another comment after that.
Sure. So the under that scenario where we would oversize the backbone system through Area 1 and Area 2 to accommodate, well, primarily through Area 1, to accommodate the flows from Area 3 and 4, essentially, you would look at what that system, the total system, who will benefit. And the benefiting properties are, if I can, let me go back to the...
Would be Area 3 and 4.
That's right. So that is why when we looked at the total number of benefiting EDUs under this scenario, it is the 3178. So the assessment is distributed among all the benefiting EDUs, including Area 3 and 4, because the oversizing was would under that scenario would be made to accommodate them. So they have a benefit. There's an added cost. We distribute the cost among all the EDUs under that scenario. Was I able to address that question?
Yeah. And then my other comment is, Ron mentioned the $4,000 being cheap, but aren't all these other properties benefiting from the investment by AD-159? Because the property owners in AD-159 built the whole backbone system, they were asked to oversize
right.
the size of the sewer lines, the pump station down the Pala, I think it's the Pala pump station down there by Murrieta Creek, and then it turns out that it was not just oversized, but the flows were all wrong. That's why we have such a big
right.
amount. So, you know, 8150 property owners 8159 paid for all this stuff, and are you just going to hand it to everyone to the east?
Well, we would definitely accommodate any additional connections that would be made from the assessment district that paid for the sewer. That would be our proposed approach. Having said that, As you indicated, Dr. Corona, the AD has been established for over 30 years now. We believe the majority that would have connected. There are some still out there. We are aware of several that still plan to develop and connect. But what we see is an opportunity because there is, as you indicated, basically stranded existing capacity. And we want to be able to build upon that and utilize that. It wouldn't make economic sense from my perspective to build a parallel sewer or build another infrastructure when we have capacity in that existing trunk sewer. So you're absolutely right. A key consideration here in trying to make this more economical for the Southern Wine Country is to utilize available existing stranded capacity in the sewer. And you're right that the AD paid for it, and we will definitely accommodate any connections that would be made for someone who paid into the AD.
My other comment, on the wells, Rancho, the vast majority of their wells are in the VDC in that Di Portola right. area. They have, like Ron said, up towards Wine Country, they have virtually nothing
yeah.
anymore. Rancho, if it's below 500 gallons a minute, they just turn it off. They're not going to use it. So all the big stuff is down in the VDC, and they pump out of two. Corey knows all this stuff, but there's two separate aquifers that they pump out of. One is the Paba, and one is the Temecula. The Paba is the shallow aquifer, and the Temecula is the deeper aquifer. It seems that recharging the Temecula aquifer would not be this. The septic systems, I don't think would affect the Temecula aquifer because they recharge the Temecula aquifer from Temecula Creek where their ponds are towards Vail Dam. and that's where they recharge that. And then the Paba Aquifer can go everywhere else. In fact, if you go down to their other ponds down here towards Galway, they have a few problems in recharge. One of the ponds doesn't perk that well, probably because it's up again closer to the hill on that one side. So yeah, it does. That's their main recharge area where they're pumping from. So I think Rancho should be a little more interested in making sure that everything keep the water clean. So anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Any other questions on this item?
Director Record, do you have any questions?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. With that, let's go to 5B information, which is the PER and the poly PFAS impacts update.
Wow.
We were all shocked because we never knew that. Neither did any of us.
Yeah.
So Linnea's going to pick up the majority of this presentation, and then I will be doing part of it as well, and we'll have to raise the podium again. But that's okay. We'll work it out.
Yeah. Somebody help her. That's it. The mic.
All right. Good morning, President Good morning. Sullivan and members of the board. All right, hopefully you can hear me okay.
Absolutely.
It was about a year ago that we did a working session on our per and polyfluoroalkylene substances, just as they were starting to really become dominant in the headlines. And although we have other items that are dominating our headlines today, PFAS issues are still very prevalent in our headlines and in our news. And so we wanted to give you an update today on regulatory actions, the state-phased investigation, what we've been doing in terms of our monitoring, our collaboration with the March Air Reserve Base, the regional activities, the state and federal legislation updates, as well as our continued response and actions. So I'm on slide 4. Over the years, there have been a variety of advisory and standards that have been developed for PFOA and PFOS. These are two of the most commonly studied PFAS compounds. If you remember, PFAS compounds are a family of about over 4,000 different compounds, with PFOA and PFOS being the most widely studied. Since our last presentation, the state has lowered the notification level for PFOA to 5.1 parts per trillion and PFOS to 6.5 parts per trillion, as well as lowering the response level for those two compounds to 10 ppt and 40 ppt respectively. This is compared to the current federal advisory level of 70 ppt for a combined PFOA-PFOS concentration. It should be noted that California is the most strict when it comes to now these notification levels. Michigan is a close second. They are in the process of adopting new standards in which they have a PFOA level of 6 ppt, 8 ppt, but they have actually an additional 8 PFAS compounds that they have included in their new regulations, with the lowest concentration for one of the Gen X compounds at the 6 ppt. There's additional regulations that have also been adopted, including some additional reporting requirements. So now, if you have a confirmed detection, not just if you exceed the notification level, if you have a confirmed detection, you actually have to report that in your CCR. And it also requires that you provide a public notification within 30 days if you exceed the response level or the notification level, whereas before you could rely on notification in your CCR. And they have also issued new general order monitoring for PFAS, just received this May. And there's an expanded investigation for additional monitoring wells. So in February of 2019, the EPA released the PFAS action plan steps, which included a variety of actions, including determining an MCL. They have, I believe, made the schedule for determining that MCL within the next 2 years. So until then, we will continue to be monitored under our state notification and response levels. On slide 8, summarizes the state's phased investigation approach. And the first phase was actually started last year when we made this presentation. And this was for all public water system wells that were near airports, landfills, and identified UCMR3 sources. And we were required to monitor those wells for 1 year quarterly. And we completed that monitoring, and I'll share the results with you here in just a couple of slides. Phase two was issued last October, and it included primary manufacturing facilities, refineries, terminals, and other areas. We were not mandated to perform monitoring under phase two. Phase three was just released last month, and this is related to monitoring discharges into wastewater treatment plants. Our phase one results are shown here on slide 9. The first table shows our East Valley wells. All wells sampled in East Valley were non-detect for PFOA, PFOS. Our Menifee Paris desalination system, the raw water that feeds into our desalination system does have detections of PFOA and PFOS that exceed the notification level for PFOA and PFOS, the 5.1 and the 6.5. However, the reverse osmosis facility that is operated as part of our desalination facility removes the PFAS to levels below the notification level. So all water entering into our distribution system is below the notification level for both PFOA and PFOS. As I mentioned, phase three was issued last month, and this is for all wastewater treatment plants that are greater than 5 MGD. It requires monitoring of influent, effluent, and biosolids, again, quarterly, starting in the fourth quarter of 2020. And our capacities for all four of our reclamation facilities do exceed that 5 MGD, and so therefore do fall under this order. The requirement is for a DOD testing method, and not only are we testing for PFOA and PFOS, but it's for 42 PFAS analytes. There are 15 laboratories that are approved for this method, two of which are Babcock and Eurofins, the two labs that we utilize. It's required that the information is uploaded to the state's internet accessible database, the GeoTracker system. And there will also be some groundwater monitoring required, which has not been fully defined yet. And so we're waiting for additional information on that component of the order. Slide 12 shows the results of our continued source sampling. So not only do we sample in response to the orders, but we're also continuing to perform monitoring of all of our drinking water sources. So in the all of our imported water that's coming from Mills and Skinner has been non-detect, as well as I already mentioned, our East Valley wells, and the water that's coming from our Hemet and Paris water filtration plants, all non-detect for both PFOA and PFOS. Two of our wells in the Paris North area, wells 55 and 57, the raw water from the wells does have some detections, but we blend that water to below the notification levels. So again, any water entering our distribution system is below the notification levels. And then, as I mentioned, our Paris South desalter wells, we utilize the reverse osmosis and are able to get our PFAS below the notification levels in that system as well. Slide 14 provides an update on our collaboration with the March Air Reserve Base. As you remember, we took well 59 out of service in May of 2016 once the federal health advisory level of 70 PPT was exceeded at that well. We are currently in construction of our wellhead treatment, the granular activated carbon system. And that system is, the construction is about 73% complete. We expect the system to be online by the end of this year. We have entered into two ESCAs with the Air Force to reimburse EMWD for the imported water that supplements the Well 59 supply, as well as for the connection to two private wells and the design and construction of the wellhead treatment at Well 59. We are also currently finalizing our negotiation for ESCA 3, which will compensate us for the O&M associated with the wellhead treatment at Well 59. Well 56 remains out of service due to the exceedance of the state's notification level for PFOA. We have not exceeded the 70 PPT at Well 56, but again, our policy is if we exceed the notification level to take the well out of service. At this time, the Air Force has declined entering into a tolling agreement. I'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. However, this is an important part of our water supply portfolio, so we are proceeding with preliminary design and the CEQA associated with wellhead treatment at Well 56, which will likely be similar to what we have are currently constructing at Well 59. So the March Air Reserve Base has implemented a multi-step process to better understand the PFAS extent, if you will, that resulted from the activities at the March Air Force Base. The first step of that was a plume delineation study that they completed earlier this year. And what this plume delineation study showed was theoretical, I guess, for lack of a better term at this point, plume that shows both PFOA and PFOS, so a commingled plume of both of those compounds. They utilized samples from an upper and lower aquifer, and what they described in the plume delineation study was that the plume extends approximately 2.4 miles south and over 1.5 miles east of the firefighting training site number 7. What they utilized was the minimum concentration, for the minimum concentration was the EPA health advisory level of 70 PPT. So the graph here, the blue, the darkest blue is representing a concentration of 70 to 100 PPT. The lighter blue is 100 to 200. As you get into more of the red areas, you're getting into the greater than 500, 1,000, 2,000 PPT, which would make sense for where we're looking at from the standpoint of the location of the actual firefighting training activities. What we noticed when we looked at this was that, as you can see here, we're pointing out Well 59 and Well 56. Well, both of those fall within this plume that is over 70 PPT, which would exceed the EPA's health advisory level. So we had a conversation with the Air Force just last week to review our comments on this study, the Well 56 location being one of our major comments on the study. And what they communicated to us was that this is based on a model simulation and projections. But because they don't have an actual sampling result from Well 56 that exceeds the 70 PPT, they do not have the authority at this point to enter into any type of agreement with us. So we're continuing to monitor and sample Well 56, and we'll continue that collaboration with the Air Force. Again, I mentioned this is the first step in a multi-step process. They are going to be doing additional groundwater modeling and monitoring as part of the next phase, a two-year sampling event that, again, will help them better define and understand this.
I have a question.
Sure.
So the purple area, that's...
Yes. On the base?
On the base. That's the worst part, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the location where the firefighting training was done.
Yeah, so there's Area 5 and Area 7, and is it migrating to the north more? Is that the two basin thing that maybe part of it's migrating north, and the rest of it's kind of migrating around?
They actually think more of it is migrating to the south, and kind of I mean, you can kind of see where it's migrated southeast, and then it starts deviating a little bit to the west, and that's related to the way the groundwater flows in the area. Yeah, there's a bedrock ridge that runs kind of right through the middle of where it starts shifting. And so it's the groundwater flow changes from kind of a southeast to a southwest flow at that point.
I was just wondering about
that. Yeah, there's
the purple area is.
Bit of a bedrock shelf underneath the base. And then as you go to the south, if you recall, down gradient of Lake Paris, there's kind of a deep incised subterranean canyon. So the fall of the groundwater levels tends to go to that kind of south-southeast-southwest kind of spread as it falls over that shelf that's underneath the base.
Okay, thank you.
One other comment that we made, there was an implication in the plume delineation study that our Moreno Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility could be a potential source. Again, it was, you know, it was soft, but it was an implication, and we felt it was important that we comment on that. The sampling that we've done at the Moreno Valley Regional Water Reclamation Plant, it does not support that implication, nor does the actual results of their own sampling. Again, based on the way that the groundwater flows and the concentrations that were at the northern part of the facility. So, again, that was a comment that we made, and we will be sharing additional information with them as they progress into their next phase to get some clarity on that issue. Moving on to the regional activities on slide number 17. Many agencies in Southern California are being impacted by PFAS. We talked about Orange County Water District last year. They are aggressively moving forward with treatment on many of their wells. The information related to the results of sampling is available to anyone on the state's GeoTracker link. This here is an example of the GeoTracker that we pulled for one of our wells, showing our non-detect at well number 26. We also have been a participant in the SOPA Emerging Constituents Study, in which we performed sampling in August of 2019. We sampled our recycled water at all of our water reclamation facilities. And the results here in the table are shown on slide 18. And you can see our treatment plants for PFOA and PFOS compared to the average of the 24 plants that were sampled. And you can see that we were below or equal to, in most cases, to the average. The other thing to note here is that we were below the samples or the results from the Santa Ana River in both locations that were sampled. Our wastewater effluent was below those the results from the Santa Ana River. And the state and federal legislation update.
Where's the magic button? Thank you, Linnea. I appreciate that very much. Let me get this set. Very good. Director Record, just to get you lined up on the presentation, we're starting out on slide 20. So I'm going to provide a bit of background on state and federal legislation. And also, I will then talk about kind of some further response in a study we're pursuing with a group of agencies to identify sources of PFAS in the watershed. So let me start out with the state legislation. On slide 20, these are three principal bills that the state is pursuing on PFAS. One deals with regulatory transparency. I'll talk about that in a moment. And the other two deal with source reduction. The first is AB 2560. This is a bill by Assemblymember Cork As you recall, the water industry had some very substantial criticism of the state's process for identifying the notification levels and the response levels. The science, we didn't believe, was very well supported. It seemed like a bit of an arbitrary process. And so what this bill intends to do is really provide a mechanism where there's a more transparent process that involves and allows public comment in the record, and that it also relies on better science before response and notification levels are set in the future. And so again, this is a broader regulatory reform bill that's proposed by the water industry. The two other bills deal with source control, and of course, being the state of California, the idea is to outlaw as many things as possible that may impact the environment. So the first bill, AB 2762, deals with cosmetics and the elimination of the sale, manufacturing, delivery of cosmetic products that contain several ingredients, one of which includes PFAS. And then SB 1044, which deals with firefighting foam and firefighting equipment, essentially preventing the sale of Class B firefighting foam and the use of it for training, and also requiring written notification when firefighting equipment is sold that contains PFAS, considering all firefighting equipment has a hydrophobic coating on it, that pretty much is all firefighting equipment that would be sold. And all these bills, the three state of California bills, appear to be moving forward through this legislative process. So let's go to the federal side. As you can see, there was no interest in the federal government in the PFAS issue. Only 60 PFAS-related bills were introduced by Congress in this Congress. Four bills I will mention briefly. That really kind of frame up the general approach we're seeing by Congress with respect to PFAS and the various avenues to address the PFAS issue. The first is the Drinking Water Infrastructure Improvement Act. This is S-3590. This passed out of the Senate Environmental and Public Works Committee. This authorized money for PFAS remediation and basically mandated that EPA develop a national drinking water standard for PFAS within 2 years. The second on that was a House Resolution Moving Forward Act, H.R. 2. That was passed out of the House on July 1st, authorized $1 billion grants and $2.5 billion to assist water utilities to pay for the capital costs to mitigate PFAS, and also direct assistance for disadvantaged communities, another $500 million. Just the note on these two bills, as well as the other two that I will talk about, is they are likely, well, will not move forward in this Congress. The Democrats have asked for additional provisions in the bills. They feel that it would be more advantageous to wait and see what happens with the election, which might augment their position in getting some of those items if the bill were to move forward in the next Congress or similar bills. Another vehicle we've seen that addresses PFAS is the NDAA, or the National Defense Authorization Act. This provides funding. Would identify and require that the Pentagon do more to address PFAS on military basis. And I think the important thing here, and one thing that's of interest to us, is that it requires the Department of Defense to follow the most stringent standard in cleaning up PFAS contamination at defense facilities, and whether that is a state or a federal level. As Linnea mentioned at Well 56, what we're struggling with is we've exceeded a state-identified level for PFAS, a response and notification level, but have not exceeded the federal level, and therefore, to date, the Air Force has not been willing to mitigate that well. So what this legislation would do is say if you have a more stringent local state standard, that the Department of Defense would have to mitigate to that standard. So this is something we're going to be watching in the next Congress. And then lastly was the FY 2020 Interior EPA Spending Bill, H.R. 7680. This also passed the House. This designates PFAS as a hazardous substance under CERCLA. This is a provision we don't particularly care for. And the reason is if you have a CERCLA designation for a contaminant, there is a chain of command or a chain of custody responsibility. What I mean by that, if it's not a CERCLA designation, you can essentially go to the manufacturers, those facilities, and they're ultimately the responsible party. Whereas if you have a CERCLA designation, if a manufacturer uses that, then it passes down and it comes into the water or wastewater stream, and then we kind of touch that by having that PFAS in our water or wastewater, and there's subsequently litigation on that, we would be in the chain of responsibility. So the CERCLA designation is not something we particularly support. Going on to our response and proposed actions, I just want to run through those rather quickly. We're obviously continuing the district's current response to PFOA and PFOS. As Linnea mentioned, our key response is that if we have a source of water that exceeds the California response or notification level, it is removed from service. Again, we think this is important to protecting the district's brand and not having to do public notification on PFAS. And then given, of course, the desalter and the treatment systems we have in place and how we've been addressing those other source water around the base, for the two wells around the base, we believe this is the best course moving forward to preserve customer confidence. So we're continuing our customer outreach program as well. I'll talk about that in a moment. And we're regionally collaborating on regulation and regulatory issues as well as legislation, as I mentioned earlier. Our monitoring program, this goes back to Well 56. Again, Well 56 is above the state's notification and response level, but below the federal health advisory level of 70 parts per trillion. We're going to continue to monitor that well. We believe that eventually that well may exceed the federal level, and then we will directly engage the Air Force on paying for the treatment that we are going to be moving forward with, but that will require ongoing monitoring. We're also doing, as mentioned by Linnea, the monitoring of the water supply sources as required by the state's order, as well as the wastewater and POTW sources. In-house, what we've also done is created a very, I think, good tool using Excel for calculating the PFAS and controlling PFAS through our desalination operation. If you'll recall, we do bypass part of the flow around the desalters. So the idea is we need to bring all the effluent out of the desalters below the response and notification levels to make sure that we do not have to do public notification. And this model helps us look at and monitor the inflow coming into the plant and the outflow to make sure we meet those regulatory objectives. On slide 26, it outlines our customer outreach and information program. This is just a sampling of the fact sheets and the frequently asked questions. We have this on the website. April and her staff have done an outstanding job in producing this materials. And we're also working with our partner agencies, specifically IUA Western and San Bernardino Valley, to do similar outreach materials on a regional basis. Finally, on slide 27, I want to talk about a partnership that we're involved in regarding a leading edge study that's being done on PFAS at a sewer shed scale of analysis. And what I mean by that, in a little bit of background, there are several Orange County water agencies that have partnered with University of California, Irvine, and their research facilities. And they have a program that they do several research projects throughout the year to basically address issues of local, regional, and national importance. One of those studies that they've identified, which has much broader application beyond the Orange County area, is to look at a process to identify the sources of PFAS in the sewer shed and where they're coming from, and I'll explain that more in a little bit. And then do it in a methodology that can be replicated elsewhere to look at potential sources of PFAS in the watershed. So the scope, original scope for the study, it's kind of interesting, is to collect over 600 samples and analyze for PFAS throughout the sewer shed. And so the methodology is going to be essentially go to a central trunk sewer in Orange County that goes into Orange County Sanitation District facilities, and then trace up into the sewer shed from there and look at pick a sewer shed that has typical residential uses, typical commercial uses, and industrial uses, and essentially sample up the sewer shed right to those sources to determine the relative contribution. So for example, if you see in one of the branches of the sewer that goes to a commercial center, a very high level of PFAS, and then be able to trace that up to the uses in the commercial center, you know, hypothetically something like a laundry or a dry cleaner, or be able to go into the residential side if you see very high levels coming from residential discharge, and then ultimately, with a second phase of the study, work into the household, do in-household sampling. Is that coming from the laundry? Is it coming from, what is the potential source, and what are the potential products that those are coming for? So it's a very cutting-edge study. The study's starting August 1st. Participants include the Orange County Water Agencies, the Orange County Sanitation District. They've also asked EMWD, IUA, Western, and San Bernardino Valley participate. They have an initial budget of $140,000 and are looking for additional outside grant funding. We've agreed to participate for $20,000, and they are also reaching out to UC Riverside and to get their collaboration on the study. So this is a very exciting study. It's going to inform a lot about the sources of PFAS, and we're really excited to be able to participate in this. And with that, we have a lot of information we've presented. We're happy to answer any questions.
I had one question.
Yes.
Not that it might not benefit us, but the House resolution requiring the Department of Defense to mitigate down to whatever the most restrictive state,
yes,
federal, wouldn't that create an incentive for states just to arbitrarily and artificially lower the maximum parts per trillion?
Sure. I mean, yeah, theoretically you could say that, but I think the presumption is that the state standards would meet some scientific threshold in terms of the establishing of those standards. But yes, I think theoretically you could say that states could just set really low levels, and then it would require the federal government to come in and mitigate. But I think the presumption is that those standards would be set through a normal regulatory process that had a scientific basis, which again goes back to the state legislation that we've been supporting, the AB 2560, which is for the state of California to have a more robust regulatory process for setting notification levels and response levels. Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, put on your, you know, future, what may be come before the board and say the next year related to PFAS in your estimation.
Well, I'm not sure I can predict what may be coming with respect to PFAS. I do think with a new Congress next year, we will see more federal legislation. If you put the circle around our area, I think we have a pretty good handle on it. I think what we are going to see is right now, you know, the focus has been on PFOA and PFOS. There's many, many other species of PFAS, and I think we are going to start seeing regulations, and I think we've heard that from the state already, that there's going to be a morass of regulations on other species of PFAS. I think they're looking at like 70 different species. So I think it's going to go outside just the PFOA and PFOS box, and we're going to be seeing other things. Would you agree that's kind of the trend?
Yeah, I would agree. And it's tricky because, you know, PFOA and PFOS were, you know, in essence phased out, but they were replaced by the Gen X compounds. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is going to be a long-term thing. And we are already seeing other states, as I mentioned, they've already added to their PFOA and PFOS, and they've established standards for Gen X and some of the other compounds.
So do we see that at some point in the future, this board's going to have to make capital expenditures to deal with this, or?
So if I can maybe assist with that, Director Paul. So there's a couple of things coming up that the board will consider relative to PFAS. One is, as Linnea mentioned, we are negotiating the third agreement with the Air Force on the ESCA to be reimbursed for the operation and maintenance of Well 59. So that agreement will be brought to the board for consideration. That's going to be coming soon. Another item that will be coming to you, in fact, we will be taking this item to the next Operations Engineering Committee and then subsequent to the board, is to advance the engineering for wellhead treatment at Well 56. So that basically starts us down the road of investing in treating Well 56, and obviously once the design is complete, there will be a construction contract that would have to be considered by the board as well. So we will have to continue to invest in remediating PFAS for Well 56, and of course we'll continue working with the Air Force accordingly to try to get reimbursed.
And I would also add to that, I think we are going to see substantial increases in monitoring requirements, especially when the state starts to regulate these additional species of PFAS, that it's not going to just be PFOA and PFOS. We're going to be monitoring for everything. Fortunately, the technology that we're using at the two wells that Joe noted, including Well 56, would be GAC, which removes perfluorinated compounds. So I don't think we anticipate suddenly, because if they regulate a different perfluorinated compound, we're going to be having completely changing or retrofitting our treatment process, because the GAC is very robust. And I think if globally you kind of step back, we're very fortunate. It's non-detectant in our imported water. Mm-hmm. We have already a very extensive treatment program in place called the desalters, two of the three desalters, which remove PFAS through the RO system. And then we're addressing that with the two wells. The only thing I think, if I was nervous about something in the long term, it's wastewater discharges. And suddenly the regulatory long arm of regulation reaching into wastewater discharges. But bear in mind, the PFAS that we strip out of the desalters is discharged through the brine line, so that's not in our normal wastewater stream.
Okay, no, I mean, that's good information from a board standpoint of what we're, you know, over the horizon have to plan for.
So. And Linnea mentions the Gen X comment. When she says Gen X, I think of a teenager on the couch looking at their cell phone. But those are something we will be watching as well.
And I want to just thank Linnea and her team for doing a good job and keeping us up to date on this, because I know this is a complex and moving issue. So
yes.
Thank you.
And the WRCOG TAC is next week, and we will be, or is it Thursday? It's Thursday, tomorrow. And so we're going to be giving a brief presentation, okay. Tim Barr and myself from Western, to the WRCOG TAC. A lot shorter than this one, believe me. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, let's go to the 5C, which is the emergency repair of the Case Road siphon. Matt.
Morning.
Morning.
So we thought we'd come back with one final update on how the repairs went and things we found from the Case Road sewer failure. So we'll talk a little bit about the community that it served, what exactly an inverted sewer siphon is, what we found of the pipeline that was in the ground, and then show you some photos of staff making the repair and what our final costs were. Mm-hmm. So this pipeline is called the Paris Interceptor Sewer, and to that end, it serves the city of Paris. The entire flow from the city of Paris runs through this segment of pipeline, and where that star is right where Case Road crosses the San Jacinto River, where we saw the failure. And then in the bottom right in that white hatched area is our treatment plant. So in the industry, these crossings are called sewer siphons, but really it's an inverted siphon and it doesn't siphon anything at all. It's just a low point in the sewer to cross some other utility or a river or something else. So this is just a general, generic diagram of what a typical inverted siphon looks like. So if the top is the road, you can see what would be the bridge in Case Road. with the bridge abutments, and so you have that inlet manhole or the upstream manhole, which is where the failures began. Our particular sewer split into two parallel pipelines, which was very fortunate for us, and became a metal or ductile iron pipe. You slope downward to the invert of whatever obstacle you're trying to cross, which in this case ultimately was just over 20 feet deep. You cross underneath, and then you slope back up to the outlet or downstream manhole. And oftentimes, the pipelines will be encased. So in this instance, both of those pipelines were encased in concrete underneath the crossing down at that 20-foot deep elevation. So this is an aerial view of the site. From the left side of the picture, there's a 24-inch VCP sewer. We got to the upstream manhole where it split into the dual ductile iron pipelines. The failure was on the 12-inch line, or what you could see in green and dark blue on the north side. So right out of the manhole, we had degraded pipe to about 76 feet away from the manhole, which was about 12 feet deep, if I recall correctly, until we found good pipe. So we replaced that. We proactively replaced 55 feet of the 16-inch line, which you can see in red. So as we were working with the city to get permits to do the repair, they were really urging us to see if we could do the work within one lane. Case Road does see a substantial amount of traffic, and they were hoping not to close the road. So we went through some efforts to see if we could do that. We were hesitant about doing that on our own, so we got some contractors to come out and discuss that and got prices for it, which looked like it would take about twice the amount of time to do the work and about three times the cost. So we ultimately decided to work with the city to close the road, which required us going to a special city council meeting. They require city council to approve all road closures. And so that picture was the Zoom meeting that was held for the city council where it was approved. And so we then moved on with the traffic control and working with the city engineer to start the work. Cozad and Fox was very helpful getting this traffic control plan you see before you. The road closure was actually a little bit complicated just due to the unique nature of Case Road by Ellis Road over there with the different roads coming together. It took a total of something like 7 signboards and a lot of different signage to set up the traffic control. The very next day after approval, we started setting up traffic control, and by 2 o'clock that afternoon, we were excavating. So as we got down to the elevation of the pipeline, in this photo on the left, you can see the 16-inch pipeline, which was still intact. And on the right-hand side is the 12-inch, and in the photograph, it's kind of hard to tell. But what you're looking at is the invert of the pipeline. The entire top half of the pipe was gone, except for the bell. So you can see the bell of that stick of pipe there was the only thing left on the top. And so all this damage was caused by hydrogen sulfide gas and started right from that interface of the flooded section of the pipe all the way up to the manhole. And so in this photograph, you can see Robert there removing the last remains of the 12-inch pipe. That kind of gives you the full view where the bottom of the pipe, there's not much metal left, and the top is gone. So yeah, it was pretty extensive. So as we continued with repairs, this was the overall job site. It was a good thing we closed the road. We did wind up fully occupying both lanes in order to access the site and the trench. This is the overall trench and the shoring that was required. It was a pretty big trench. Most of the time for the repair was spent excavating, and replacement of the pipeline actually went fairly quickly. And this is just the staff laying the new sections of pipe. And here's the completed. You can see the two new lines. You can see the new line meeting up with the healthy line. That was the 16-inch side. And then finally, a backfill compaction and what the completed site looked like after we were done. It took about right at 10 days to finish the whole job. So this is the summary of costs we spent. We spent $106,000 in total. Our estimate, if we had contracted this out to complete the work within one lane, we estimated would have been $260,000. So the staff did an excellent job of getting the work done in a timely manner and at an effective cost. And that was all I had.
I want to also recognize the work Matt did to get this organized. It was done ahead of schedule. We also had to make a compelling case to the city management and Public Works and Engineering team that this needed to be done with a full road closure. We felt not only because of the cost savings, but a safety situation. As you saw, if you're familiar with that area of the road, it's a fairly narrow two-lane road. It has ungraded shoulders that go down to V ditches. We just felt that it was an unsafe condition to do one lane at a time, given the depth of the excavation. And so we needed to put a lot of technical materials together that we could use to compel the city. Matt and his team did a great job on that, and then in executing the project with our force account labor. So just want to recognize that, and then also express my appreciation to the city for allowing us to close the road, because we really needed to do that. So thank you, Matt.
I would add, Matt was on vacation when this whole thing went down. So I appreciate him stepping up.
Jeez.
Between this and coronavirus, it was an interesting vacation.
Yeah.
Timing is everything.
Yeah.
Any questions for Matt?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, let's. We're going to take a time out here and go to the Finance Authority.
So, direct.